The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2017 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2017. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Well, welcome. This is the workshop entitled Beauty Matters, Creating a High Aesthetic in School Culture. You will not have to write any metaphors for this one. It's part of the foundations track that many of you have been participating in. You had some assigned reading. I don't know how many of you did some of the assigned reading, but it's from actually this book called The Fragrance of God by Vigen Guroian. It's a magnificent book. I'll be plugging this one as well as I go through the talk. By way of introduction, this workshop really is about understanding beauty and appreciating how beauty affects the loves of our students, and some very practical ways in which we can beautify our schools and make them sacred spaces for the contemplation of the true, the good, and the beautiful. My concern here is a relatively common one. I think we're pretty good when it comes to teaching truth and goodness, but we're not that great when it comes to beauty. We know that truth, goodness, and beauty are central to the classical parlance, but the way Christianity's worked itself out over the last 30 years, it tends to be much more conducive to the truth side of things, and perhaps even the goodness side of things. And I'm thinking particularly in terms of worldview categories made popular through Francis Schaeffer in the 70s. Worldview categories tend to lend themselves to really thinking about what we believe and why it's true. You heard it from Robert George, know what's true and why it's true. And we're pretty good when it comes to moral issues, trying to explain to students what is sin. It's grace to get caught. God loves you so much, he caught you, right? So now we can end this. But then ask your faculty members, what is beauty? What is it? How do we know what it is? How is it objective to the knower? What is its role in relation to truth and goodness? What's its role in relation to the student? What do you think you're going to hear? Crickets. There you go. That's right. Crickets, yeah. You tend to hear either very confused things, or you just get a lot of confusion. You get this with your students, too. They will say, they come in maybe around 7th grade, 8th grade, 9th grade. They believe Christianity is true. They understand its moral imperatives, its obligations. But don't tell me what movies to watch. All right? Don't tell me what is really good art. Don't tell me what's good music. Who are you to tell me these things? And then what's our answer? This is where it gets hard. See, when you're dealing with truth, you quote a scripture, right? When you're dealing with beauty, crickets. It's hard, okay? That's what this workshop is going to be all about. This workshop really is making sure that you leave here knowing what beauty is, how to identify it, how it relates to your students, how you can explain it to your students, and then how you can put it into practice in your schools. Beauty matters. That's kind of a metaphor, isn't it? No? Not really. Not really. I wouldn't get any prize for that. Now, just so you know, I'm not immune to this. This is hard. I think this is really hard, what the modern age has done to beauty. Remember, science is all about truth, right? At least that for a while it claimed it was. Now, postmodernism comes in and says, well, truth is all relative, including that of science. But even while we were claiming truth is relative, we were putting urinals as art exhibits. And I'm not immune to that. I taught aesthetics class side by side with an apologetics class. And I taught my students their worldview categories. And what's your worldview categories, right? How do you know what's involved in a worldview? Well, their conception of theology, right? Their conception of metaphysics or physics, what's real and all that. Their understanding of what it means to be human, anthropology. Their understanding of knowledge, right? What we call epistemology. And then their understanding of ethics. What is morality? What was I leaving out? Aesthetics. I stopped. Aesthetics was for aesthetics class, and it had nothing to do with apologetics. Alexander Solzhenitsyn quoted Dostoevsky in his Nobel laureate speech, and he was absolutely convinced that beauty was the Christian apologetic. David Bentley Hart shares the same opinion in his book, Beauty of the Infinite, that beauty is the Christian apologetic. Beauty is something, everybody can lay claim to some kind of truth, some kind of morality, but there's a beauty to Christianity that belongs to it and to it alone. So we've really stepped away from that. Well, maybe there's something to that, and let's explore that together here. I do think it is concerning, I should say before we take off, because I think if we're not teaching beauty, what we're doing is we're sneaking in relativism through the back door. Truth, goodness, and beauty all need each other, and they imply one another. They can't be sequestered from one another. And you can be sure, I'm on a Christian college campus, and you can be sure that if beauty is believed to be subjective, personal, and private, truth and goodness are sure to follow. They're going to follow. Guaranteed. They need each other, and they're the same reasoning by which you can relegate beauty to a personal preference, so you can relegate ultimate truth, a personal private commitment, nothing more. All right, so what's so awesome with all of this is that when you do teach your students beauty, guess what? They really find it beautiful. They're enamored by it. Literally, enamore. They fall in love with it. They're attracted to beauty because that's what beauty is. It's attraction. It draws them in. I'm repeatedly told by my students when they're seniors that their favorite class of mine was aesthetics, the study and encounter of beauty. And what I find in terms of their little testimonials is they always felt that something was missing in their worldview. The truth and the goodness was incomplete. And then when they get introduced to beauty, they're like, that's it. That's what I've been missing. Now it all makes sense. So let's dive in. Let's explore what is beauty, how it relates to the formation of virtue, and how we can effectively communicate this to our students. And then we'll look at some representative ways for beautifying our schools and transforming them into sacred spaces for the contemplation of the true, the good, and the beautiful. All right, so what is beauty? And I can't really see the screen, but is the screen clear? Is that all right? All right, very good. Basically, the way I like to introduce beauty to people is through understanding its relationship classically to truth and goodness. The three terms, of course, are the center of our classical Christian parlance, but it would be good here to start with an overview of what these terms actually mean. The terms truth, goodness, and beauty, aletheia, agathos, and kalos in the Greek, they were already pretty well established by the time you get to the really cool truth, goodness, and beauty guy, Plato. In the 5th century BC, the upstanding citizens of Apollis, the Greek city-state, they were designated as the kalos kai agathos, the beautiful and the good, which was then later contracted to kalikagathia, single term. But it's not until Plato that you get this systematic interplay between truth, goodness, and beauty as macrocosmic values, values embedded in the world around us, and then the interplay between that and us as human beings as microcosmic replications of that macrocosmic world. One of the most important things you have to get across to your students, we'll talk about this also in more detail in my next workshop on the Misopidea. One of the things that you have to get across to your students is the fundamental difference between, say, pre-modern mind and the modern mind, is the pre-modern mind believes the world is filled with divine meaning and purpose. I don't care where you go. You can go to ancient Greece, ancient China, Japan, Africa, Russia, you name it. Wherever you go, they believe the world is filled with divine meaning and purpose. And for the classical world, that divine meaning and purpose was understood in terms of three grand cosmic values, aletheia, agathos, and kalos, the true, the good, and the beautiful. And truth, goodness, and beauty corresponded to the human person who was, in a sense, an image of these three cosmic values. So I have a soul that can receive these values. Truth communicates to my intellectual capacities. Goodness communicates to my moral and ethical capacities. And beauty communicates to my emotional and my aesthetic capacities. The way Plato would work it out is he saw the soul as made up of sort of these threefold parts. The logos, which is my intellectual capacities, the themos, my moral capacities, and then eros, my desiring capacities. It's made a little bit more famous by Aristotle. You know your three modes of persuasion in rhetoric? Logos, ethos, and pathos. Well, those are connected to the idea of truth, goodness, and beauty. Truth, aletheia, literally means to reveal or disclose. It's the negation of lethein. Lethein means to hide. And then you put a little A in front of it. That's called an alpha privative. And that negates what it's prefixed to, like an atheist. Theist is, you know, believer in God. An atheist is no God. So aletheia literally means to reveal or disclose. And it reveals the nature of reality, specifically to our intellectual capacities. The term agathos, the good, it connotes the excellence of a thing or a person, and it was eventually developed by philosophers to designate the goal or the purpose or the meaning of existence. And so I have a good marriage if I'm living out the purpose of marriage. I have a good watch if it does what? if it does what a watch is supposed to do. And while truth reveals reality to my intellectual capacities, goodness reveals reality to my volitional and moral capacities. But what's perhaps most stunning in this whole micro-macrocosmic relationship is the role that Plato ascribes to kalos, or beauty, particularly in Diotima's speech in his work entitled The Symposium. Basically, beauty is the loveliness, the radiance, the delightfulness, the delectableness, the luminosity of the true and the good. One might even say the glory of the true and the good that draws the human person toward the true and the good by directing our eros, our loving desires. It's essential to understand here that beauty, classically speaking, is a physics. It's every bit as objective as the law of gravity. This is why we associate beauty with attraction. Through beauty, we're drawn to the true and the good, the divine source of life. And we're drawn there by awakening within us our eros, our desires. We desire whatever we find beautiful. The reason why classical education is so concerned about ordering our affections and desires is precisely because it is first concerned with truth, goodness, and beauty. And beauty awakens desire. So this is the first thing we have to get. This is the first thing we have to nail down. Beauty is a physics. Most of my students could repeat that in their sleep. Beauty is a, what's beauty? Beauty is a physics. Beauty in the classical world functions like the law of attraction. It's a gravitational pull, like a tractor beam for you Star Wars fanatics. Beauty draws me somewhere. Oh, is that Star Wars theme? I thought Darth Vader was coming in right now.
Luke.
Beauty draws me somewhere, and this is key. If it is beautiful, then by definition, it must draw me to the true and the good. You've got to get that. If it's truly beautiful, by definition, it has to draw me to the true and the good. What's the first problem we're running into now? Wait a minute now. Just a moment's reflection revealed that not everything I find beautiful is what? True and good. And then that leads us to the role of beauty in the ordering of our loves. When we look at Genesis chapter 3, what do we see? We see Eve, is she measuring the fruit? Is she quantifying the fruit? Is she doing scientific experiments on the fruit? What does it say? When the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and that the tree was desirable to make one wise. Do you hear the affections? Now, right here, we have a major, major roadblock in front of us. This is where your understanding of the fundamental difference between the classical vision of the world and the modern secular vision of the world really kicks in. Now again, my next workshop is going to get into the step-by-step contrast between the classical Christian world and the modern secular world, but here's a snippet. The classical and Christian age believe that the world is filled with divine meaning and purpose, and this is what they call the cosmic values of the true, the good, and the beautiful. And the goal of education was to align the students' affections and desires and loves with those cosmic values. So they love what's truly lovely, desire what's truly desirable, and hence experience human flourishing. Conversely, because of its devotion to scientific rationalism, our modern secular age does not believe the world is filled with divine meaning and purpose. Instead, the world operates solely by biological, chemical, and physical causal laws. That's the truth, goodness, and beauty of the modern age, biology, chemistry, and physics. And they are, by definition, value neutral. The whole reason why science is considered to be a means of knowledge today and valued as a means of knowledge is because supposedly it transcends values. It transcends our preconceptions. It transcends our cultural biases. It calls them to account. Thus, there are no longer any cosmic values today by which the students' affections can be rightly ordered and arranged. And so what we value, what we desire, what we love, it's rendered completely subjective and person relative. So this is what our students are breathing in when they come into the classroom and say, who are you to define art? Who are you to tell me what's beautiful? What's good? Who are you to tell me what's good music? It's bad music. Why do I have to read this book? It's boring. Subject, boring. School, it's boring. Now, to counter that kind of skepticism, you cannot say so that you'll get good SAT scores. I will come and I'll kill you. I'll spend the rest of my life in prison. You can't do that. You can't out-secular the secularist. To counter that kind of skepticism, I don't know why I just said that. It's not in my notes. I'll kill you. I'm tired. It was an 8-hour workshop yesterday. I'm just mad and cranky. I'm going to kill you. Can we edit that? Oh, my. What on earth? I'll never come back here again. To counter that kind of secular skepticism, we have to offer our students a fundamentally different world. One that's filled with divine meaning and purpose, and therefore obligates us to conform our lives into a harmonious relationship with it. Here's how C.S. Lewis put it in his Abolition of Man. Quote, "Until quite modern times, all teachers and even all men believe the universe to be such that certain emotional reactions on our part could be either congruous or incongruous to it. Believed, in fact, that objects did not merely receive, but could merit our approval or disapproval, our reverence or our contempt." See, what a close quote. What Lewis is saying there is that the world in which we live is worthy of our praise. The worth of a sunrise for us to go, wow, that's not a meaningless, purposeless, physical, biological, and chemical event that I just happen to impute meaning to, but that's an event that actually has value in and of itself, and then it calls me to bring my affections in line with it. Lewis then summons some of history's greatest minds as witnesses to such a view of the world. He cites Augustine's conception of virtue as orto amoris. Are you familiar with that? It's really cool. Got to teach your students that. We learn in Genesis that God has created a world that is good. Every time God creates something, what does he do? He ascribes value to it, right? Objective value. Again, this isn't value that I get to come up with. This is value that God came up with. And then what we find is that he created an economy or order to that goodness. So you notice in the Genesis account that when God creates mankind, it's the first time he says, and it was very good, excellent, it was very good. So notice the superlative. All of creation is good, but when it comes to mankind, we are very good. We're the image of goodness, right? Now, what Lewis is pointing out is that this orderly goodness in the world provides now an objective model by which we're able to order our affections, since it's a world that merits our praise. This is how I basically teach it to my students. I say, look, it's good to love a baby, and it's good to love a ham sandwich. But if they're both falling and you rush to save the ham sandwich, I have to argue this with my male students. They ask me, what kind of ham is it? Is it ham on the bone? What kind of ham and Swiss? Was the baby annoying? Eventually, they come to terms with the fact that, all right, if I rush to save the ham sandwich, that's a bad. Now, what's the bad? Is it the ham sandwich? And or is it the baby? What's the bad? The bad is I've dislodged my loves from God's economy of goods. I've dislodged my loves from the economy of goods as God created them. So how does beauty fit into shaping our loves in accordance with God's economy of goods? One of the ways I like to illustrate how beauty fits into this is with the Greek mythology of the muses and the sirens. You guys remember that? Muses and sirens, right? So the muses are the daughters of Zeus who inspire works of truth and goodness and beauty. And what are the sirens? All right, they're these sea witches, these sea nymphs that draw sailors and lure them where, ultimately? To their death. And how do they do it? By singing. One beauty leads to life, but the other supposed beauty led where? It led to death. Beauty always awakens a desire. And this is key. If it's true beauty, the desire it awakens is to surrender myself to the object of my affections. Think of agapic love. True beauty awakens within me a sense of emptying myself in order to be filled up with the object of my affection. This is why a husband or a boyfriend might get on his knees to propose to his wife. My wife is here and she's thinking right now, you never did that. Okay, I'll do it. No, I'm not. I'm a cranky old man right now. I love you, honey. Beauty always awakens within the person a desire to surrender oneself to the object of attraction. False beauty awakens a desire to control and dominate the object of attraction. Beauty awakens love. False beauty elicits lust. Truth attracts, lies seduce. I once heard an excellent lecture on the theology of sexuality by a scholar who's also a Catholic nun. And she asked the audience, for what does a prostitute get paid? And the audience was kind of chuckling and not quite knowing what to say to this nun. And she smiled as well, and she said, fine, I'll answer it for you. A prostitute gets paid to leave. The prostitute does not get paid for sex. There is nothing out of the ordinary of a sexual encounter. What's out of the ordinary after such an intimate encounter like that? For the person to leave. Love surrenders itself to the object of its attraction. Lust dominates and controls it. This is the difference between nudes in an art gallery and nudes in a porn magazine. We are living in an age because we do not have and we do not recognize the divine economy of goods. We are living in an age that cannot tell the difference between love and lust. In a word, if you want to understand what's going on today with our ethics, our sexual ethics, why toilet bowls are part of art exhibits, we do not know the difference between love and lust. And as a father of two teenage girls, that enrages me. That we live in a world we think this is hip and cool. To laugh at anything that's true, we consider true, good, and beautiful. So, when our students are attracted to something that they find beautiful, what's the first question we need to ask them? This is a second order thing, okay? There's nothing you can do about it. You come, you see something, and you're like, whoa! Right? It's very visceral. I'm attracted. So, what kind of reflection needs to be asked at this point? You had this encounter, now what? Is it true and is it good? For example, Lady Gaga Music videos may attract me. They don't, honey. May attract me, but they do so in drawing me to something, namely a world devoid of meaning and purpose that's there to be conformed to my needs and my desires. This is why she's always at the center of the screen in her videos. She's the center of her own world. Her artistry celebrates the emancipation of the sovereign self. Now, of course, this is not to say that there's nothing good about or true about Lady Gaga's music. She is, after all, part of a musical tradition, 2,500 years that was sanctified by the church. It is to say, however, that the student needs to develop discernment when listening to her music so as to be able to approve of the good and reject the lies, to love, not to lust. So the first thing we need to get is beauty is a physics. It's a gravitational pull that draws me to the true and the good. And secondly, it draws me to the true and the good by awakening self-emptying love within me that seeks to serve the object of my affections rather than to control and dominate them. So how do we effectively teach that to our students? And this is where I want to bring in some of the reading that you did. And it's and again, if you haven't, no problem, I'll summarize it. It's from a chapter entitled The Fragrance of God by Vigen Guroian, and it's from the same entitled book. I'm sure Eighth Day Books has it out there. They can order it for you. Now, I had to read this essay because I think it's one of the best introductions that I've come across to the Christian tradition of redeeming the senses or restoring the senses. I've done some writing on this in the book, Awakening Wonder, and also on the new website, the new Turley Talks website, we have a teacher training video series that gets into this really in depth. But this tradition, what I mean is it is central to understanding that between the soul and the loves of the student and the objective world around them, there are the senses. There's the body. And the body's like a mediator between the loves and the world around them. And what this tradition argues is it's not just the soul that fell in the garden when we left. The senses fell as well. The senses somehow became numb. Have you ever tried to eat a wonderful meal when you had a cold? Okay, that's what happened in the fall. We're desensitized to God's paradise, his beauty that's all around us. And so in the context of Christ's redemption of the world, what he has in fact done is he's brought paradise back. He's restored paradise. We're going to get into this a little bit more. And as an extension of that restoration to paradise, now we have a new purpose for art and music and poetry. The purpose of literature, art, architecture, music, poetry, drama, the purpose of the arts and music is to sanctify our senses in such a way that our loves end up loving what's truly lovely and desiring what's truly desirable. In fact, this tradition has some really beautiful applications. When we sanctify our senses through a sanctified art and music and poetry, in many respects, we're preparing our bodies for their future resurrection when Christ returns. That's powerful stuff for students. They are blown away with that. These are missing ingredients. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, it's good. But whoa, you mean the purpose of art is to mediate eternity to me in such a way so that it wakens my senses and prepares me for my resurrection? Sign me up. That's awesome. That's really cool, and they respond very, very positive. Now, Guroian, of course, focuses on the sense of fragrance and the restorative role of gardens, which we're going to get into a bit. But in accordance with this notion of beauty as a law of attraction that draws us to the true and the good, it does so by awakening our loves and our desires to be filled with truth and goodness. And we need to teach our students that the whole purpose of art and music and literature is to provide an aesthetic bridge that facilitates a communion between the human soul and the true and the good and the beautiful by awakening our senses. This is what makes good art. This is what makes good music. It serves as an aesthetic mediator between the loves of the human person and that eternal reality which the human person ought to love and thereby cultivates virtue. Whenever my students say, "Dr. Turley, I really dig this song, it's really cool," they always know what's one of the first questions I'm going to ask them. "So how does it show me paradise? Why don't you just show it? I bet it's great, but how does it show me paradise?" And then they try to explain it. They try to show me how it's a mediator between myself and the eternally true good and beautiful. So good art and music, as mediators of this communion, anticipate and prepare us for the transfiguration of the cosmos when Christ returns by giving us a foretaste of that transfiguration. When you go into art museums, this is the fundamental difference between them. The fundamental difference is not subject matter. We have the Philadelphia Art Museum right nearer to us. You know, Rocky has steps, all that. Going up to heaven, right? Lifting his arm. All right, okay. It's cool. I love Rocky. But when you go in there, you go into 12th, it starts around 12th century art, and it's not just, this is what's so bad with some of these art tours, because they'll just fixate on the biology, chemistry, and physics of the artwork. It's not just that the subject matter changes when you go from, say, the medieval art and Renaissance and Reformation art all the way into the Enlightenment and modern art. And when you start seeing, like, you know, paint cans spilled over and things like that, and condoms as art exhibit. It's not just content. Those are two fundamentally different universes. Those are different worlds. One is a world where art is actually a mediator. It's a communicator of divine reality that calls me to it. It seeks to draw my loves towards eternity. In this other exhibit, modern exhibit, that world died. It's gone. And now you have meaningless, purposeless processes of biology, chemistry, and physics. And now I, as an artist, I'm going to try to figure out what meaning means to me. And look at how cool it is. And by the way, your tax dollars can pay for it too. It's two fundamentally different worlds. Art and music are mediators of eternity. Art and music are mediators of eternity. And if they're not mediators of eternity, watch out. You got a siren. Okay? They don't have to be into it. The person doesn't even have to know they are doing it. Do you know that? You guys know Serrano's Piss Christ? There's another thing you're going to edit. You guys know the painting by, I forgot his first name. Serrano's Piss Christ. You can look it up. Serrano. It's a picture of a crucifix submerged in a jar of the artist's own urine. And I've shown it to my students. I haven't gotten a bad call yet from a parent, but I've shown it to my students in a aesthetics class, and I asked them, "What do you think of this?" And they're horrified. And so why do you think he did that? Sometimes students can, they get it. I remember I had one student say, "Because he's a coward." And I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "I'd like to see him do that to the Quran." And I was like, "Yes. You're awesome." But he's got a point. And I said, "Yeah, he's a coward, but he's also an evangelist." Because what is the legitimate reaction of submerging the Quran in a jar of urine? What would the Quran say that should happen to you? Right. Very good. But we can keep going. What if we did that to the law? What would Moses say? What did Serrano do? However inadvertently, he submerged Jesus in a jar of urine, and how did Christ respond? With his arms open in love. The gospel according to Sirana. He had no idea. The more you spit on him, the more you show forth the infinity, the boundlessness, the fathomlessness of his love. He wanted to give us blasphemy, and it is. And we're living in the midst of a gospel that in many ways can't be blasphemed. It's so miraculous and transformative. You see, if a kid came in and said, "Hey, Turley, don't you think this is cool?" I'd say, "Show me paradise. Where is it?" And it's even in a jar of urine. It can be found there, but you have to have the moral imagination to see it. And that's what I think we need to train our students to do. They can love the good. All right. Let's get into it. How do we put all this together? Let's talk about music first. Now, I have to say that one of the great impoverishments in our schools is that the musical means of learning tends to die out after seventh grade. So chants fill our classrooms in the grammar school only to be eclipsed by the lectern in our upper school. And we sequester singing to the specialization of the choir teacher. So what we're doing at Tall Oaks, I know what they're doing at other schools, is we put an emphasis on filling our school building with singing, particularly in the upper school. So, I mean, literally, we have our upper school students begin as many of their classes as possible by singing through the Psalter at the beginning of class. Four-part harmony as a way of sanctifying the space. It's common, of course, to offer a prayer at the beginning of class. And that's great, but I think it was Augustine who said that he who sings prays twice. So we have to understand that for the ancients, music is very, very different than we think of it. We think of music as basically entertainment. It's something you put on an iPod. But that's not how the ancients thought of music. Music was not something that was basically composed or performed or played. Music fundamentally was a mathematics, right? You know your quadrivium? Okay. And mathematics were the patterns of perfection upon which the entire cosmos was modeled. Now, you can't see numbers. They're invisible. You can't bump into them or smell them. They don't extend in time and space. But you can hear them. You can hear them in the frequencies of pitches and in the ratios of intervallic relationships. And so when students are singing, and they understand this whole cosmos of divine meaning and purpose and all that, in many ways, they're learning how to live in a harmonious relationship with the cosmos redeemed in Christ. And I've been doing this for many years, and I'm convinced that my students learn more theology from singing than any stupid lecture I can give. And I can honestly tell you as well, there's nothing that's contributed more to the formation of a distinctively Christian culture, a Christian harmony, in our upper school than getting our students to sing throughout the school day. I've listed basically five ways that you can incorporate music through the school day. I would certainly allocate certain times in the day for plenary singing and prayer. We sing together as an entire upper school first thing in the morning, along with reciting corporate prayer. Our students sing the doxology at lunch, and we sometimes end the day together in song as a school. Organize music according to the seasons. This sanctifies time. So we can program our music according to the liturgical calendar of Advent, Christmas, Epiphany, Lent, and Easter. And this is where you break out the hymns. Use music in Latin and Greek class. And this is where you can introduce students to Gregorian chant and what's called the Greek octoichos, or the eight tones, each representing a different spiritual state. And there are a number of resources on the web for you for that. Begin class with singing, as I just alluded to. I'm not exaggerating at all when I say, as an educator, that perhaps the most important parts of the school day are the times at the beginning of class when we sing psalms. When our alumni come back and visit us, the first thing they can't wait to do is run into our class, grab a psalter, and sing with the class in there. And then we always say, well, you get to pick the psalm. This is something they take with them for the rest of their lives. If you're unfamiliar with the Psalter, I would suggest the Book of Psalms for Worship, published by Crown and Covenant, and the Psalter Hymnal, published by Contis Christi, or the Psalter Hymnal Contis Christi, that I'm sure is on Canon Press's booth. And then learn to sing in parts. Unison singing is fine, especially in the context of ancient chant, but in many ways, we're losing the ability to sing in parts. Our PowerPoint-addicted church can't help us on this one. We're going to have to preserve it. And if you get these psalters, you will. It's a beautiful expression of the unity and diversity in the fellowship of the Trinity. How about art? Along with cultivating a distinctively Christian acoustic environment in our schools, we ought to be concerned with the sanctification of the visual as well. Now, our school, as well as a number of schools I've had the privilege of visiting, have begun to stress the importance of pictorial imagery for cultivating the visual imagination of students. Now, I know some schools that have parents who are artists, and because either they own the school building, they've gotten permission from the church, or whoever's renting the building to them, they've been able to paint murals in hallways and very lovely full wall paintings in classrooms. Regardless, I believe it's important for students to learn how to read an artwork. And this involves fostering the practice of what's called gazing, a practice employed by reading iconography. The visual arts provide the opportunity to sanctify sight by uniting our eyes with our intellect. We sanctify sight by uniting our eyes with our intellect, such that the depiction of divine images is experienced by both sight and soul. So one of the examples I like to use with my students when I'm teaching them how to read a painting is Ecce Ancilla Domini by the 19th century English artist Gabriel Rossetti. It has a number of very striking and beautiful features, like the use of white for Mary and Gabriel, a blue backdrop, and the red loom adorned with lilies, complementing a lily held in the hands of Gabriel. Make sure your students know the meaning behind classical color schemes. Red signifies eternity. Signifies love. Blue signifies eternity. White represents purity. Green signifies life. Gold represents the presence of God. Black represents death to oneself. Lead the students to explore the meaning of the painting as the colors come together to tell the story. Note, too, the dove between Gabriel and Mary there. What's the significance of doves in Scripture? Right? Of course, the Holy Spirit, as with Christ's baptism. Notice the backdrop behind the dove. Notice the blue. Can you hear the echoes of Noah? Or see echoes of Noah to work? But notice further Mary's countenance. Why does she appear so concerned? Invite the students to reflect on this. It's actually my opening question. It's my prompt to get the discussion going. Why is she so concerned? And you get all these very, very interesting things. But say, no, but tell me from the painting, why is she so concerned? Can you see it? Then show them. Show them the shape made by Gabriel's left hand as it intersects with the lily on his right hand. What do we see? We see a cross. Both hands, too, are making signs for Christ and the Trinity. When you see two fingers extended, that usually means the incarnation. Okay? And if you see three fingers put together, it usually means the Trinity. Mary's eyes are staring at a symbol that is teaching her that not only is she going to give birth to the Messiah, but he'll be the sacrificial Lamb of God taking away the sins of the world. Teach them how to read paintings. And I've seen it myself. They will stare artwork for hours. And the painting transfigures before their very eyes. Quickly, something about spatial arrangements. This is big, actually. If you walk into my classroom, you're going to notice a few things. And I'd have pictures, but they were like cleaning the floors and waxing the floor, so everything was out of the classroom, but never mind. You're going to notice a few things right off the bat. If you walk into my classroom, you'll see artwork on the walls. You'll see a number of library shelves with books. You'll notice that there are no desks in my room except for mine in the corner, a nice big old wooden desk. Instead of individual desk chairs, I have a number of tables that form a long three-sided rectangle with a number of very comfortable folded-up chairs, with another table right in the middle, which is situated over a Persian rug with my lectern in front and the whiteboard. Now, when you walk in, you obviously know this is a place of learning. It's not a locker room. It's not a faculty lounge, although some of my colleagues will use it that way. It's a place of learning. The lectern is facing one way, the chair is facing the other, books on the shelf giving a library feel. It's a place of learning. But you'll also notice, too, when you walk in, you'll get a sense that this is not a place for just a bunch of lecturing. Why? Because where are they sitting? They're sitting at tables. And what do you do around a table? You talk, right? I want my students talking. I want them talking a lot. I want a lot of conversio. But I need the space to get them to do it. Notice further the difference for the student. What is a classroom set up with individual desk chairs in fixed rows convey? Doesn't it convey that education is individualistic? I do my own thing. It's my report card after all. But what do tables do? I have to sit with somebody. They create a sense of community. Now, I'm not saying that this is how you have to do it. What I am saying is that you need to think about your classroom arrangements and what it's communicating to your students. This is what scholar Peter McLaren calls the hidden curriculum. Isn't that a great phrase? Peter McLaren, the hidden curriculum within our schools. The subtle messages that are sent to our students through our day-to-day practices. So what message is sent when we assign music solely to the extracurricular? What message is sent when we don't do music unless you signed up for the Glee Club or something? Same with art. What if our walls are bare or littered with these self-affirming posters, "The mind is like a parachute, it only works when it's opened"? Stupidest thing in the world. We need to be very, very cognizant of our hidden curriculum when it comes to our classroom arrangements. All right, gardens and landscaping. This is my classroom. No, this is our school, ha ha. At one level, of course, landscaping and gardening is going to be governed by your facilities, especially if you're renting. But what a number of schools are doing is they're taking seriously the beautification of their school grounds. And this is generally undertaken by parent volunteers, but if you have a budget for this, and I think we ought to, if we can, this is worth raising money for, but if you have a budget for this, it's a great parent volunteer opportunity to be a groundskeeper of highly manicured landscaping. And I think it's something that our school is taking more and more seriously. This, of course, elicits the reading of The Fragrance of God, a vegan Guroian. And if you recall, for Guroian, gardens are important because they act most explicitly as foretastes of new creation. We have to understand that among the early Christians, the person of Christ involved nothing less than the return of paradise. This is particularly evident in the Greek and Syrian traditions, where Christ is the Logos, the one through whom all things were made, who was originally experienced and revealed in his acts of creation, particularly in the habitat of paradise. But as the result of paradise being lost in the fall, the Logos becomes man in order to reveal to us once again what paradise looks like. Now, paradise is a person. Yeah, by the way, the movie Up captures that beautifully. It does. Pixar's Up. Remember Carl? And he's looking through the adventure book, and it suddenly hits him that Paradise Falls isn't a place. It's a person. You're crying. And so... And so one of the most beautiful gifts that we can give to our students is the realization that Jesus is paradise. His cross is the tree of life restored. The waters of Eden are restored in the waters of baptism. The grain and fruit of the third day of creation are transformed into the bread and wine, identified with the body and blood of Christ, so that creation and incarnation come together to restore our relationship with God and with one another and renew the world. These Edenic frames of reference awaken the moral imagination of the students, and gardens are beautiful context to awaken just such an imagination. This is us. All right. Let's talk really quickly about culture. Like Adam and Eve in paradise, a Christocentric life needs to be cultivated in a particular kind of space in order to grow and blossom. And that's how I see the school community and the culture. The way we approach our school community and culture is very much relevant to the notion of beauty in the lives of our students. Now, I mentioned throughout the workshop, and I think the school, first and foremost, must be appreciated as a place constituting a sacred space for the contemplation and practice of the true, the good, and the beautiful in the lives of our students so as to allow their faith to flourish. I think it is foundational that we lead our students and our parents to appreciate that the various practices and etiquettes and arrangements and standards that make up the life of our school collectively reveal the school as a sacred space. I don't need to tell you this, but you're going to get challenged by student and parent alike about your rules and your standards. You're going to get pushback on that. And if you respond with, well, that's just the way we do it, or we have uniforms so that no one wears anything inappropriate, you're shot. They're going to smell a rat. And they should. You're being utilitarian. You're being a good Darwinist. They're going to recognize that these rules and standards are basically arbitrary. They're just there because someone has the power to do it. However, if you explain to them that the rules and the etiquettes and the standards of your school are there to reveal beauty, they're there to mark the space off as sacred, students and parents immediately realize something. They realize that sacred spaces require what? Special rules. Just go into the Capitol and you'll find that out. Special places require special rules. That's what sets December 25th apart from any other day. And we need to underscore for them that the whole purpose of these rules is not to stifle, it's not to impede, but rather, as G.K. Chesterton said, to allow good things to run wild. You know that quote? It's awesome. From the Orthodoxy, the more I considered Christianity, the more I found that while it had established a rule in order, the chief aim of that order was to give room for good things to run wild. Just like in sports or music, the magic happens only when one learns and masters and indeed loves the rules. And where does that love come from? Beauty. School uniforms, they demonstrate a common telos, a purpose or goal. This is the case with all uniforms, whether sports or military or the clergy. Uniforms embody a shared identity, a shared purpose, and thus our students are encouraged to exercise their individual gifts for the benefit of the whole group the whole community to the glory of God. And hence Paul could say to the Galatians, you were all baptized in Christ. You have been clothed with Christ. You are all one in Christ. And again, I like to push the color of my uniforms on my students. We explored this earlier. Our uniforms are blue. Blue represents eternity. So I like to remind them that every time they put on their school uniforms, they're being prepared for eternity. You see, we can look into the eyes of our students and say, by embodying these special rules, they reveal that you yourself are sacred. You've been set apart. You've been bought at a price. Glorify God in your bodies. We are out of time. I have another curriculum section here of how we can put beauty through our curriculum. But you're just going to have to go and buy my book because it's the last chapter in that book. I don't even think we even have time for questions. I think that's about it. Thank you, everyone.